This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Dan Hurley. The National Cancer Institute shows your race may have an effect on whether cancer will kill you. We're talking about why that is and what you might be able to do about it. Joining me to discuss the topic, our Deputy Director of the UC Cancer Institute and Professor in the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at UC College of Medicine, Dr. Thomas Herzog, and UC College of Medicine Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience Assistant Professor Dr. Maria Espinola. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, emailing talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
So I thought a good place to start was just tell us some of these statistics and how they vary from varying races. And Dr. Herzog, you want to start or Dr. Espinola?
I can start.
Okay.
Sure. So some examples include that African-American women are less likely to develop breast cancer, for example, than white women. However, they are 40% more likely to die from it. African-American men have a 74% higher risk of developing prostate cancer than white men, and they are also more than twice as likely to die from it. Hispanic women have the highest rates of cervical cancer, nearly double that of white women. American Indian women are 40% more likely to have kidney cancer than white women. And Asian Pacific Islander men and women have 2.1 and 2.3 times, respectively, the incidence of liver cancer as the white population.
Why?
There are several explanations for it. So first, it has to do with prevention, screening, and lifestyle changes. So, for example, if we were to target eliminate smoking rates, we will cut cancer rates by 30%. Obesity accounts for 20% of cancer rates. So those issues play a huge role. So that has to do with it. The other part has to do also with cancer care. Oftentimes, minorities are treated differently. And you had UC professors earlier this year speaking about that. But oftentimes, they are not, the doctors don't recommend prevention programs for tobacco or obesity or exercise routines. And many times because they are treated differently, minorities refuse to go to a doctor altogether, and they delay treatment and prevention.
Dr. Herzog?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's multifactorial. I think Maria outlined some of the major causes, such as tobacco use. You can't underestimate the impact of obesity and the lack of exercise and what type of diet someone may eat at a lower socioeconomic strata. Patients in that strata often have a mistrust of the healthcare system. There's a lack of screening that Maria alluded to, and I think that makes a big difference because now you get late diagnosis. And if you get late diagnosis in cancer, that usually portends a much worse outcome where the cancer is spread much further and our treatment options really become much more limited. So there's also poor access to care. There's substandard care in some cases where the patients aren't going to the best healthcare systems and getting the best care sometimes. There may be increased rates of viral exposure and environmental exposures as well. And there can be problems with compliance, even with the treatment plan and follow-up and so forth. So all those things come together and really create this disparity.
Let's talk a little bit about maybe diet and exercise first. That's something that most people can change. It may not be easy to do it, but probably the easiest way to do it. What are some of the things you would advise people in some of these ethnic communities, ethnic backgrounds to do to make them less likely to develop cancer or die from it?
So I think something that has been successful is to ensure that the approaches you're taking are culturally sensitive. So Ohio has a Ohio Commission on Minority Health, and I serve on their medical expert panel. And they have implemented some approaches that are successful. So, for example, instead of regular exercise, they have salsa for Latinos, or they have yoga for the Asian population. So something that could be accepted by the community is more likely to be successful from the get-go. Also, when it comes to diet, ensuring that you are taking into account what are the values. There are specific, we get attached to the foods we like, right? So we grow up and we remember like how nice it was to have grandma cook a specific meal for us or, you know, enjoying time with the family and everything. So you want to keep those things in mind. Like it's really hard to go from a specific diet that you got used to it growing up to completely change and become vegan as an adult. That's really hard. And probably you'll be unsuccessful doing that if that's, you know, that's your case. So you want to do something that is gradually implemented, that respects your values, and that is doable. So I think what is really important to highlight is something that is doable, that is feasible for you to implement.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think being culturally sensitive and being practical are keystones to success. I do think the first thing that really needs to happen, though, is education. And I think that many people don't make that link that what I eat and being overweight really puts me at a much higher rate of developing a number of different malignancies.
So how do you get this education out there? Is it, you know, you talk a lot about the ethnic backgrounds, the ethnic differences, but is it also socioeconomic as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So income like definitely plays a role. So you see huge disparities when it comes to poor individuals from all races. So yeah, certainly, because that reduces the chances that they will get access to care. And then when they get care, it will be lower quality. Also, their exposure to smoking as well. So as children, they are more likely to be exposed to smoking, and then they are more likely to get addicted to smoking as they grow older.
Aren't the smoking rates going down?
Not really. So a little bit in Ohio, but Ohio has one of the worst rates. So, and then when it comes to public health and prevention, Ohio ranks 50 out of 50.
Worse than Kentucky and Indiana.
Yes, that's a very common comment from people. Yes, yes.
Well, that's surprising only in that Kentucky is such a tobacco state, you anticipate that the numbers there would be worse.
Yeah, so smoking rates are worse in Kentucky than Ohio. But when we talk about all public health and prevention, including smoking, exercise, and everything else, Ohio ranks worse than Kentucky.
Why do you think that is? Or do you, I guess I'm asking you to guess here, but is there?
Well, so they looked at the numbers. It has to do with how the budget gets divided. So they found that it's between 3-5% of the budget got invested in public health and prevention, and everything else went
to clinical. This is the state budget you're talking about.
Yeah, went to clinical care. Mm-hmm.
So what do you advise your patients, Dr. Herzaga? Do you see the people that are experiencing this?
Well, we do, because we take care of the full spectrum at the University of Cincinnati. But we, you know, that's only a small percentage of our patients. So it's very mixed. Some of my patients can preach to me about diet, and they know more about it than I do. And yet others are really not educated in this area. We have nutritionists that are available at the Barrett Cancer Center, and we will get consults with those patients who need that education.
You talk about the importance of getting treatment sooner rather than later. Talk about the importance of screening and how people that maybe don't have money or don't have insurance might still be able to get that, or can they get those screenings?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when it comes to colon cancer, that's one type of – it's the second most common cancer in Ohio, one of the most common cancers in the United States.
Tell me which kind this was again, colon?
Colon
cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that is something that people often miss, like how preventable actually colon cancer is. It's 50% preventable through screening specifically. So something that people can do is to first – so I think a huge barrier for people is to first know that a screening makes a difference. So what I hear a lot, I'm a psychologist, so people come to see me a lot to share their fears and their worries. And they oftentimes say, I don't want to go to the doctor. I'm afraid of what they're going to say to me. What if they tell me I'm sick? I don't want to hear it. Because they assume if I'm going to get sick, I'm going to get sick regardless. So what's the point of knowing that now? I'd rather live without knowing that, and then I deal with it when I get there. That is a really common mentality, so that has to change. It has to change so let's talk about colon cancer. If you go and get a screening and they find colon polyp, they can remove it, and you can prevent yourself from having colon cancer altogether. many times. So you have to really go early. So now the recommendation is if you're 45, you need to start doing the screenings then. So that's a new recommendation. And then the doctor will tell you when to come back. And then if you have a first degree relative, for example, who had colon cancer, you want to go 10 years before that relative was first diagnosed.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100 if you have a question or a comment today. And we go to Karen. Hi, Karen. What's your question? Karen just went away. All righty. Well, I think she was talking a little bit about people that said on the screen that she was interested in people that can develop cancer and lung cancer having never smoked or never been around smoke. So it's not strictly related to smoking.
True.
Absolutely.
So in those instances, even environment is not always a factor.
Or environmental factors that we don't understand yet.
For example, just pollution or things of that nature.
Could be a number of things, right.
Do you find in the years that you've practiced, and I don't know, how many years have you been practicing?
20-some. I stopped counting.
So has it changed a lot as time has gone on? Do you find that these kinds of numbers have changed greatly, or are you just noticing them more now in terms of the disparities?
Oh, I think the disparities have always been with us. I think the good news is that there's better recognition of the problem. So one of the things the UC Cancer Institute recently did was host a retreat here and over the Rhine. In fact, just catty corner from the studios here. It was just last month, and the title of the retreat was Making Cancer Care the Great Equalizer, Science and Solutions for Health Disparities in Cancer. So we brought in several PhDs from a number of notable programs, including MD Anderson, who really focus in this area.
That's the hospital in Houston?
Correct. Mm-hmm. And and we had Maria on a panel. We had Anjanette Wells from UC on a panel and others that it really we had 80-some people there. It was a wonderful day, full day, where we really looked at the problem and we focused more on some of the solutions. So I think that part of it was really rewarding in terms of looking at, you know, what are some of the things that we can do to try to overcome some of these disparities.
What are some of the solutions? What did you talk about?
Well, I think first and foremost is what we've alluded to, and that's community engagement. And that really starts with building trust and being culturally competent and a number of other solutions that are not so easy. They're easy to say, but not so easy to enact. We looked at the problem with clinical trial enrollment because clinical trials very often in cancer often offer the very best care. So you often get standard of care plus the new most promising thing that may be out there, and that very expensive compound may be paid for fully by being on a clinical trial.
How hard is it to get into those trials?
Well, there are eligibility criteria and so forth, but what we find is even when a minority or an elderly person is able to fit the eligibility criteria, there's less of a chance for them enrolling. There's a number of barriers that we've seen in terms of the system being somewhat dismissive of, oh, they're not going to be able to keep up with all this, the patient themselves being somewhat distrustful of it, or just not understanding what a clinical trial is and that it's truly not being a guinea pig, but rather participating in research that may offer you the best care possible. And so I think that's one of the things that we focused on. Was looking at clinical trial designs and how we could tailor these trials better for minorities and elderly patients that have these disparities. So we need more social science research. We need more basic science research. Some of these disparities are probably explained by genetic changes as well. So it's a combination of behavior, environment, and genetics. And so I think all those things are extremely important. And then we have to look at ourselves and say, are we providing equal access to care and the same standard of care? And I think we certainly strive to do that on a daily basis.
Again, our number is 513-419-7100. Susan's on the line. Hi, Susan. What's your question?
I just wondered what your feeling is about the people not looking into vitamin D deficiency and the relation to especially advanced cancers, especially in minorities.
Yeah, I think that certainly there's emerging research with some of the not only vitamin D, but some other vitamins that are important. And it goes back to baseline diet. And I think we do need more research in this area, but it's an important point that you raise.
Thanks so much for your call, Susan. We appreciate it. Again, our number, 513-419-7100. When it comes to things like vitamin supplements and those sorts of things, is that something that you advise patients? Is that something that you even get to, or do they come to you once they are already diagnosed with having a problem?
In my case, I usually see patients once they're suspected of having a cancer or actually have been confirmed to have a cancer, but not always. In general, I advise patients to have a well-rounded diet. And if you're eating appropriately, there's probably in most cases not a need for vitamin supplementation, although it depends on what your diet is, and there could be holes in it depending on certain choices. But in general, I'm someone who personally doesn't believe that you need to take a vitamin every day if you have a well-rounded diet.
Well, you talk about different ethnicities. Do certain races and ethnicities have different kinds of diet needs? Like some people maybe have more vitamin D or others do not. Or is that even a fair question? I don't know.
I'm not aware of the data on that. I am sure there is data, and I'm sure that there are differences because there's having lived in New York City and seen some of the different diets, it was very interesting to me.
What did you find? What was interesting?
Just different food choices, like you said, culturally in terms of, and I enjoy those, so it was wonderful. But I just thought to myself, what if you ate this every day? How would that go? But maybe people don't eat that every day.
So. Sort of like the whole Mediterranean diet
exactly.
that they talk about
yeah.
now and other things like
yeah.
that. Is there anything that people can do to help others? I mean, maybe you're not in one of these groups that has a high mortality rate. How can, as a community, do you think everyone work together to make it better? Or is it something that people really just need to take on for themselves?
Well, I would love to see more collaboration. We are certainly thinking about it and discussing this right now. Because what we did during the retreat is to look at successful models, right? So Delaware, the state of Delaware, did an unbelievable program, and they still have it. It's the Delaware Cancer Treatment Program. And what they did there is just advocates, physicians, legislators, they came together. Well, we have a problem here. We need to fix it. And it's not going to be fixed by individual people or an individual cancer center or individual university. We have to be together on this. So the governor I approved that, and the legislators went ahead and support that. So what they offer was universal screenings for different types of cancers. So what I did is I presented on colon cancer specifically. So they actually eliminated the incidence disparity. It was no longer.
So it was equal between.
Yes, over time, right? Mm-hmm. It was unbelievable. And then they reduced mortality disparity significantly. So for mortality drop among African Americans in Delaware after doing this, 42%, and mortality drop among whites was 13%. So.
And we're seeing other pieces of evidence that we are closing the gaps on some of these disparities. So I do think we're moving in the right direction. There was a presentation at ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, just this year that looked at prostate cancer in African Americans, and the numbers were basically equal now to whites in at least this study. Now, that doesn't mean everywhere that's still the case, but that was very encouraging that we are being able to see progress.
I thought the one statistic you gave that was very interesting was as far as breast cancer, where African American women get it less often, but they're more likely to die from it. Why do you think they get it less often? Is that also an ethnic trait?
So I wouldn't be able to tell you very specifically why they get it less often. We do know why they were dying more at a higher rate. So that's what I discussed during the retreat. So breast cancer is 33% preventable through not consuming alcohol, maintaining a healthy weight, and staying physically active. So that's important to keep in mind. But then when people already have it, so reducing mortality is a huge issue there. So Chicago did a great program. And at some point when they started this program, Black women were dying at a rate 62% higher than white women. So it was incredibly high. They look more into it. They found that high mortality rates were caused by less access to mammographies, lower quality of mammography services. So even when Black women will go and try to get these services, were lower quality, so they couldn't recognize the cancer early enough. And then less access to and lower treatment quality. So again, advocates, physicians, and community leaders created a task force focused on addressing healthcare inequities, and they were incredibly successful on that. So I think it's important to look. So it's not about reinventing the wheel, right? It's just looking at what has worked, and let's do something similar here.
And I think that we would hypothesize that there's some unique biologic and genetic underpinnings that perhaps are go into causation, such as the penetrance of BRCA gene, which is a gene that
some kind of people call that BRCA, right?
Correct, mm-hmm. and increased susceptibility to breast and or ovarian cancer. And so I think there's a number of related genes as well that we don't know the prevalence of as well as we do for that gene, that it may be different between African Americans and Caucasians.
In just a few seconds we have left. So genetic testing at some point also may be able to help in that area then.
Yes, they found that genetics account, when you look at all the cancers, genetics account for about like 5% of all cancers, but there are specific cancers when they play a much bigger role. So yeah, you want to look into it too.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being here. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great. Thank you for having us.
Especially Dr. Herzog, you said you rushed out of surgery in your scrubs to get here, so I'm impressed.
We've
been talking about the effect race has on the cancer mortality rate. My guests today were Deputy Director of the UC Cancer Institute and Professor in the Division of Gynecological Oncology at UC College of Medicine, Dr. Thomas Herzog, and UC College of Medicine Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience Assistant Professor Dr. Maria Espinola. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Our assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Today's technical director was Josh Elstro. Our intern is Layla Shakui. Archives of our program are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Dan Hurley.